Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Hello, and welcome to ID the Future. I'm Casey Luskin, broadcasting with Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture in Seattle, Washington. Today we have on the show with us a very special guest. Many of our listeners are familiar with him. His name is Michael Behe. He's professor of biochemistry at Lehigh University in Pennsylvania. He's the notorious author of leading ID books such as Darwin's Black Box and The Edge of Evolution. And he's also recently the author of a paper in the journal Quarterly Review of Biology titled Experimental Evolution, Loss of Function Mutations and the First Rule of Adaptive Evolution. And we have Dr. Behe on the show with us today to talk about his new peer-reviewed paper in Quarterly Review of Biology. So, Dr. Behe, thank you so much for coming on the show with us.
Thanks a lot.
Well, Dr. Behe, I am very excited about your paper. It's a peer-reviewed scientific paper in the journal Quarterly Review of Biology. Obviously, the type of paper that our critics say is not supposed to exist. And I was wondering if you could briefly just give us an overview of what your new paper is about.
Yes, for the past 40 years, scientists have been very interested in trying to do evolution experiments in their laboratory. That is to see under controlled conditions how organisms can change. And they can do that with microorganisms like bacteria and viruses because they're very small and they reproduce rapidly and they reproduce in very large numbers. So they can really follow what changes there are in the bacteria. And my paper reviews all of that material and shows that a lot of bacteria and viruses improved in many experiments, but in general, they improved by deleting material they already had, by throwing away genetic information to make things that were useful to them. And for some reasons that help. It's kind of like throwing away, if you're in a rowboat that's sinking, throw away a heavy computer or something that's weighing you down. So we have seen in controlled experiments that evolution works, Darwinian evolution works, but it seems to degrade organisms more than build them up.
Well, Dr. Behe, of course, in your paper, you talk about gain of function and loss of function mutations at the molecular level in what you call functional coding elements. Can you explain to our listeners what is a functional coding element, or an FCT as you call them?
Well, yes. Everybody's heard, I think, of the genetic code and that DNA carries coded information. And it's really true. It's like the Morse code, you know, where dash, dash, dot means a letter or something. And the same thing with the units called nucleotides of DNA. When you have certain ones in a row, they carry an actual meaning. And there's lots of different codes in the DNA, not only codes that are for structural things called proteins, but there are what are called regulatory codes too, things that tell a gene when to turn on and turn off and how much to increase and whether to put an extra group on a protein or not. And the genome is just chock full of these functional coded elements. So I surveyed the papers that had done experimental evolution in the laboratory and see if any of them had ever reported that a new functional coded element was produced. And again, the answer is in one or two cases, yes, but it was generally the case that the investigator had removed that element and the system kind of replaced it. But for the overwhelming number of papers, no functional coded element was produced completely new that wasn't there before that did something interesting or something different. So it seems to be a big evolutionary difficulty to make these positive elements, functional coded elements.
So Dr. Behe, what do you mean by gain or loss of function?
Well, heck, Darwin himself, Charles Darwin, proposed the theory of evolution, but he knew that organisms could adapt or could fit themselves better into their environment, either by getting some new feature or losing an old one. For example, there are fish that live in caves in the dark, and they have lost vision. They have lost their vision and much of their eyes. And it seems that because their eyes are of no use to them, they have deteriorated so that they are pretty much non-functional. So they have adapted to their environment by losing something, losing a function. Suppose you were in a boat, a rowboat or something, and it started to sink. It was leaky. And in your rowboat, you had a couple of big packages. One big package contained a sophisticated computer. One way you could help yourself survive is by getting rid of the heavy but functional piece of equipment, a computer. So since evolution is random, it will adapt an organism by either losing something it's already got or by gaining something that it doesn't have. And so I wanted to go back and look at these experiments to see if there was a predominant mode of evolution.
You then, of course, go on to review a number of studies of molecular evolution and whether or not they involved gain or loss of function at the molecular level involving an FCT. What was your finding? Do examples of adaptive evolution at the molecular level tend to involve gain or loss of an FCT?
Well, I was surprised the overwhelming number of adaptive mutations, that is, mutations that help the organism, are either loss of function or, at best, what I call modification of function. That is, where a pre-existing function is kind of changed a tiny bit, but most of the mutations were loss of function ones where an old function was destroyed or the modification function where a pre-existing function was tweaked a little bit, but it was not either made anew or destroyed. It was very rare. There were only a few cases where there was what I would call a gain of function.
In your paper, you reviewed work on both bacteria and viruses. Did you find anything different between bacteria and viruses in the sort of evolutionary adaptations that they undergo at the molecular level?
Yes, bacteria and viruses are a bit different, but not all that different, in that both viruses and bacteria mostly adapt by loss or modification of function, and it's rare that they gain a function. But viruses, it turns out, have gained functions more often than bacteria, but only under special circumstances. In some of the experiments I reviewed, investigators deliberately took out a functioning piece of the virus's DNA and then wanted to see how it might evolve to compensate for that missing piece. And in some circumstances, if it was small enough, the viruses were able to re-evolve that same piece or something very similar to it. So that was a gain of function. But interestingly, it was just a gain of a function that had already been there. It was not a brand new function.
What about the work of Richard Lenski, Dr. Behe? You review Lenski's work in your paper, and does it show that your arguments about the edge of evolution are refuted, as some have claimed?
Well, I greatly admire Lenski. He's done the biggest experimental evolution experiments for the past 20 years. He's been growing a bacterium called E. coli in his laboratory at Michigan State and just watching how it changes over time, watching how it evolves. And over the course of several decades, he's published quite a bit about his experiments. And of course, going back and reviewing, I spent a lot of time on his work. And he, too, has reported that a number of mutations in the E. coli that he is evolving helped it grow in his laboratory. They were adaptive, beneficial mutations. But when he went to determine exactly what the mutations were, many of them were loss of function mutations, and some of them were also modification of function. In other words, the bacteria were improving themselves by throwing away things that were no longer of use to them. Again, in his particular experiments, he did not see any gain of function mutation. So the biggest evolutionary experiment in the history of the world, essentially, a gain of function mutation was not seen.
So Dr. Behe, what is a general overarching principle that we can take from your paper? And in fact, you close with what you call the first rule of adaptive evolution. What is that, and can you explain it and what its implications are for us?
Yeah, I kind of try to summarize the reviewed results in what I dubbed the first rule of adaptive evolution. And the rule is this: break or blunt any functional coded element whose loss would yield a net fitness gain. Cells are composed of many genetic components, and it's oftentimes adaptive to the cell, helpful to the cell, to get rid of one or more of them. And in the examples I reviewed from past 40 years, it seems that the easiest and quickest way for a cell to adapt is to simply get rid of something, and that oftentimes will help. And this is, I think, a very important take-home lesson, that at least in the short term, cells and probably animals and plants as well will adapt to their environment by breaking things that they already have, because it's faster and because they have so many functional parts that breaking one of them will likely give a positive result.
I guess for someone who is not in the thick of this scientific debate, what is the takeaway point that you would give them?
Well, it's this. The take-home message is that the adaptive evolution we see around us, such as antibiotic resistance or the adaptation in laboratory experiments, is not the kind of process that we need to explain how life got built up in the first place. Loss of function, even modification of function, helps an organism by essentially degrading it, by feeding off of the complexity it already has. Many organisms, the ones I reviewed in the article, organisms that develop antibiotic resistance and so on, do so by degrading the complexity that they already have, kind of feeding off of that. But what we need to explain is how organisms got there in the first place. How did complex systems, how did gain of function mutations arise over time? And from what I was able to review, it seems like that might be a considerably different process than the adaptive process we see in our world.
Well, that's really fascinating, Dr. Behe. And, you know, as I read your paper, I couldn't help but think that if you have a process of adaptive evolution, which by and large tends to remove or slightly modify functional coding elements rather than produce new ones, then if you sort of look at the background rate of gain versus loss of these FCTs, it seems to me that over time, eventually an organism is going to have net losses of these functional coding elements until perhaps there's nothing left to lose. And if this is the direction that adaptive Darwinian evolution is pushing biological organisms at the molecular level, it doesn't seem like it's a sustainable process by which they ultimately can evolve new or more complex biological systems. Is this thinking at all on the right track?
Well, yes. Maybe we could call this Cheshire Cat evolution, you know, that over time everything disappears except the smile. If you are losing function elements, if a species is, over long periods of time, then there's got to be a way to put them back in, or to have gotten them there in the first place, or essentially the genome will degrade into a very simple one, maybe even a simple one that can't support itself anymore. So we know now that adaptive evolution, the good evolution, the kind that helps organisms, still isn't enough to explain how the complexity of life got here. We need not only something that can help, but something that can construct. And we don't see that in the examples that I looked into.
Finally, Dr. Behe, is there anything that you'd like to say about the publication process as you publish this paper?
Yes, I would. I would like to say that I had a very positive experience with the journal Quarterly Review of Biology and was treated with professional respect at every stage of the process. I sent in a manuscript initially, and it was reviewed and sent back, and they decided that as it was written, it was not in good enough shape to publish, but they said that if I could answer their criticisms of the reviewers and whip it back into shape, then they would reconsider it. And I did that. I looked very carefully at the criticisms. I tried to address all of them and sent it back in, and they, at that point, decided that I had successfully met the criticisms of other reviewers. So I have to say that I recommend the Quarterly Review highly as a very professionally run organization where the editors do their job seriously and well.
Well, that's great news, Dr. Behe. And again, congratulations on the publication of your paper, Experimental Evolution, Loss of Function Mutations, and the First Rule of Adaptive Evolution. I hope that you don't lose any function today and have a great week, and we really appreciate you being on the show with us.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me on.
Well, I'm Casey Luskin with ID the Future. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2010. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.